ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Corbin Middlemass. Have you got Ashes fever? Well, we've got the perfect podcast for you. It's called ABC Cricket Podcast. I'm joined by former Australia opener Ed Cowan every Monday and Friday, as well as after every day of Test cricket all summer long. The Australia-England rivalry has never been bigger, so make sure you're across every angle. This is the best analysis and insights on the game, and it's coming your way. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land. Our summer season rolls on, bringing you the best of Late Night Live 2025. In his first fortnight back in the Oval Office, Trump signed three executive orders of remarkable cruelty, each designed to make life tougher for transgender, non-binary and intersex Americans. Lately, Trump's people have begun turfing transgender soldiers out of the military. It's distressing, perplexing and weird, but in the hands of Alok Vaidmenon, it's also desperately funny. Alok is many things, a comedian, a poet, a campaigner for trans rights, and a huge social media star with about 1.5 million followers. Alok came to Sydney for Mardi Gras and joined me in the studio, I must say, in a fabulous dress. Now, Alok, you're wearing a simple shift with the words fresh produce across the bodice. Could you further describe your outfit for our listeners?
Well, you know, it's become apparent to me from my political administration back home that transgender people are capable of magical powers, chief among them the price to single-handedly raise the cost of eggs. So I figured that if I came dressed as the grocery store, and that way I could remind people that the real issues are inflation and not us.
And not transgender rights.
Yes.
That's extraordinarily generous of you.
And I just wanted to be a little bit fruity because it is Mardi Gras.
Fruity, yes. Now look, you have expressed in your work a good deal of sympathy for those people you call people who wear pants. Mm. How's my fashion?
I'm surprised we're going to such a controversial take already this early in a political podcast. What I will say is I appreciate the effort.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, Alok, even before Frank Sinatra toured this country, people in my position have always had to ask, as I'm going to ask you now, how do you find Australia?
Well, this word use really is just compelling to me. It reminds me of y'all from my childhood, and I've been trying to deploy it as much as possible. And on this trip, the term bogan has entered my vocabulary as well, which is just stunning. I rather like it here. I think my only critique is I'd like a sense of urgency, you know? People are very relaxed, and I'm such a New Yorker. I'm like, let's just immediately connect and divulge our deepest, darkest secrets, and people here are so much more leisurely about that. But other than that, I have no complaints.
But the grammatical point you make is extremely important. We have a plural you, which is yous, and a singular you, which is you, which I think could be adopted around the world, don't you think?
I think so.
Because that word is so fraught.
Yes, yes. Instead of you guys, we've got yous. Australia has been really a thought leader in the space of gender expansive language, I have to say.
Thank you. Look, I'll pass that on, and our listeners will pass that on. What's been the response of people seeing you in the street? You tell such horror tales of the reactions in even New York.
Yeah. You know, it's always complicated for me to come back here because on my first tour here in 2016, I was unfortunately physically assaulted after I spoke in Melbourne on a tram in the middle of the day. And so I've always got this connotation in my head about Australia and violence. And I think that's actually why I keep coming back, because it's important for us to remain visible and to not concede any ground. So there's this kind of unease that I had already coming here, then peppered and seasoned with the news from back home there's just this overwhelming sense of ominousness and this foreboding kind of gurgling in my stomach that so many people are feeling emboldened to exercise their own self-hatred out on me. And so I've had to be vigilant. Fortunately, nothing has been too wrong. Of course, there are always looks and stares and comments and remarks, but I have managed to outweigh that with the overwhelming tsunami of love that I'm experiencing at these shows. I mean, the crowds here are just so vibrant.
And you're about to go to one of the biggest shows on earth this Saturday night.
Mm-hmm. I'm so excited. I've heard so much about it. It's such an institution, and it's exciting to finally see it.
What a wonderful word for Mardi Gras, an institution. Now, how come your family ends up in Texas?
Yeah.
And tell us about a Texan upbringing.
Well, there's a lot of, you know, folklore about how it happened, but the hypothesis I have is that there was a group decision between God, my mother, and the doctor that we wanted to create the funniest child ever. So we figured if we expose them to just this extreme and incredible duress, they would have comedic material for the rest of their life. So at the time, it was really womp womp. But now, 20 years out, I'm like, that was so amazing. Cool. Yeah, I'm grateful because I have so much to talk about.
So you're grateful for the experience, despite what might have been quite painful along the way?
I feel like it's given me an ability to understand what's happening in the world right now. You know, I grew up with people who people would balk at and be like, how could you have a relationship with someone who double majored in Bible and business at a small Christian college? But those were my best friends growing up, and I've maintained connections with them, and I understand how people become conducted into their own echo chambers and how those echo chambers become sort of virtual realities that make us live in simultaneous landscapes. So I feel like when I saw what's happened nationally in my country, I was like, oh, this is just a slice back home. I know how to handle this.
That's Texas writ large.
Yeah.
You're not in an echo chamber?
I think we all are. But one of the joys of my job is that I get to travel a lot. And so I get to puncture at least my provincial Americanism, which is one of the worst forms of provincialism because it postures itself as universal.
Oh, we're familiar with that in Australia.
So I get to be in rooms where people are speaking about things I have absolutely no idea what they're about and remember that the world is so much more tremendous than what I'm going through. And I think that's been very helpful these past few weeks that I've been away to remember that whatever is going on there is not the entire world.
Your friends might have gone to Bible college, but you went to Stanford and you studied what you were to become. Was that deliberate?
I feel like it's very unfortunate that it took undergraduate and eventually graduate work to get access to histories that should have been made available to me in just general public education. I came to Stanford with a lot of questions because I felt like so many pieces of me were irreconcilable. Most of the Indian communities that I was a part of in Texas were incredibly heterosexual and cisgender. And then most of the LGBTQ communities were overwhelmingly white. And I didn't understand how I could be both of these things. And so when I went to Stanford, was the first time I actually got access to archival materials to understand the thousands of years of history of gender fluidity from South Asia and the ways in which British colonialism, in fact, imported and institutionalized a gender binary. And when I learned this information, it gave me so much power because for so long I had felt like I was unprecedented, like I was some fluke or glitch in history. But through scholarship, I learned that I was part of a 1,000-plus-year continuum. And I think that when you deny people history, you deny them legitimacy, you prescribe them loneliness. And that's why I think so many of the attempts of this administration are to disappear our scholarship and our history because it makes us feel unmoored.
Is there a war going on in America against scholarship?
I would say not just scholarship, but against critical thinking. The powers that be want people to think that the world is easily decipherable and obvious. And that is heretical, because the world, as Mary Oliver once said, is only obedient to mystery. And so actually skepticism and critical thinking and a robust imagination are passports on how to navigate every day. And so the crisis could be described as one of forcing people into gender norms, but I think it's a larger epistemological crisis, which is forcing people into an easy and reductive view of reality, telling people there's only four options, three options, two options, is a way of, in some sense, denying people their human birthright to dream and to imagine beyond the confines of the now.
Make America simple again.
Yeah.
You didn't get onto the stage, if I'm right about this, until you'd graduated from Stanford. So you did all the academic work, you made all of these discoveries about history, and isn't it splendid to see the British Empire providing laws criminalizing homosexuality around the world, and some of them still doing such good work? I mean, you've recently been in Africa, you will have seen some of the good work those laws are doing there, with the assistance, of course, of the church. What got you onto the stage?
So I actually did start performing in college. I was part of a poetry collective, and those were my best friends, because what we'd do is every Sunday we would come together and process our lives, and then we would workshop our poetry together. And a lot of that cohort of people are accomplished artists today, like the renowned novelist Yaw Jesse. There's so many people who I went to school with who continue to be involved in the arts and continue to be my colleagues and my interlocutors. But I think what propelled me to start performing was when I was at my first year orientation, I saw some members from this poetry collective perform, and they were saying poems about things that I didn't think we were allowed to talk about in public. Issues like mental health, issues like colonialism, issues like sexism. And so many things that had been shrouded in secrecy were just immediately available and palpable and felt in that room. And I realized that art was actually the place that we could be honest, that all of this outside of art is a simulation. That's the conundrum, is that people think that I'm performing, but what do you call a 9-to-5? What do you call the comedic bit of saying, this is who I am? I am is the funniest joke I've ever heard in my life. Actually, what a performer does is hold a mirror to society and say, we're all performing. And so in that way, performance is honest. And so I think what really compelled me about performance in the stage was I was desperate for a wellspring, a watering hole, a reservoir of truth in a world that often felt so sutured together with lies.
Is that where you discovered the power of laughter?
Yes, because I regret to inform you that I used to be very depressed. It was really this strange agenda I had. I thought that it was original, but apparently it's deeply felt by everyone. And so a lot of my poems at the time were deeply sad, poems about pain and trauma. And the issue is you can't really convince people to buy tickets to a show if you have an hour of very sad poetry. It takes a particular
kind of
person.
You'll get an audience. It might be small.
Yeah, just to show up. Like, most people are like running away from their problems. Very people are like, I'm going to pay money to go and confront my problems. And so in between poems, I started to crack jokes to sort of ease the tension.
This is a safe space for members of the straight community. You're allowed to laugh at me for the next hour and not get called transphobic. Honestly, I'm a major fangirl of you guys. That was me being culturally sensitive. You guys.
And then I realized that I was having more fun cracking the jokes than writing the poems, because the jokes were improvised, the poems were preset. And with a joke, I could read the room, take a pulse, and experiment and risk. And what I found is that laughter was able to relieve tension so that we could be true. We can make people laugh so that the mouth can receive truth. In a world where we're so dissociated, I think laughter is often our first point of entry back into our bodies.
Is there anything that can't be laughed about?
No, I just think you need to find the right comic to write the joke.
What do you think of people who say, you can't joke about that?
I say, love and light. I'm so sorry that you think that it's going to heal you to cordon off the possibility that actually healing is available to you on the other side. What comedy is for me is a continual reminder that we are so expansive, so dynamic, maybe even cosmological, celestial, that any injury is just that, a minor incursion on our might. Comedy requires us to expand. That's what laughter does. And so I wish these people a new dose of expansiveness. And I want to be clear, like, I used to be one of those people, right? Like, I used to be very serious because I felt like it would undermine my advocacy and the severity of what I was going through if I cracked a joke. And then I realized part of the architecture of the oppression was requiring me to legitimize the farce. What I mean is being more concerned about what I wear rather than a wildfire ravaging your entire country is a joke. And so if I was to just say, wow, I'm valid, I am legitimizing the superstructure, which is the farce. So what comedy allows me to do is to hopscotch away from that preset paradigm and say, no, I'm not the joke, this is.
It's been particularly brutal for those of us who are mediocre transgender athletes. Despite the fact that we lose the majority of the sports the majority of the time, the press just reports the few times that we accidentally win, leading to the widespread misconception that we have an unfair biological advantage to win every sport every time, which is frankly a lot of pressure. I never thought I'd have to come out on stages and say something I thought we already all agreed on. Trans people are losers.
I'm talking to Alok Vadmenon, poet, comedian, performer, advocate. This is the best of Late Night Live 2025 on ABC Radio National. Alok, what you seem to be heading towards is that things of immense importance, like half of Los Angeles being wiped out by fire, can be on the same plane as jokes about what you're wearing down the street.
Yeah. What I'm saying is what we've seen done so well, we have to commend them, is the manufacturing of hypothetical crises as a weapon of mass distraction from what is urgent. I believe that a lot of the anger and indignation and frustration and confusion that is being expressed all across the world right now is so legitimate. It's just misdirected. It's been misdirected at migrants, misdirected at Muslims, misdirected at trans people, when it should be directed at states who have facilitated the monopolizing and hoarding of wealth so that people are concerned with 10 transgender athletes competing in sports versus the 10 billionaires that hold the entire world's resources. It's been a long-standing multi-decade practice that is now coming into fold. And so what I'm trying to do in my work is to say, I actually think we have more in common than we have apart. It's just that you and I are grieving from the same system. My grief may take the form of experiencing harassment on the street, but your grief may take the form of a sense of listlessness, a lack of rootedness, a lack of integrity and purpose that makes you only find community through hating me.
Is there more to it than distraction, though? I see your argument that, you know, if we can be arguing about pronouns, we're not arguing about inequality. Mm-hmm. But is there something else there? Is God also telling people there is only man and woman and there's some kind of vengeful God working through this as well in the politics of the United States? God can be such an angry figure in America.
Well, we actually have the data to show that what happened was a group of evangelicals were deeply concerned about a challenge to their theology and knew that it wouldn't be a compelling political advocacy to say God believes in two genders. They had seen how that rhetoric didn't work with same-sex marriage. And so they needed to find a secular argument. And so they began to pay scientists to actually espouse this belief of there's only biologically two genders, and they use biology as a way to masquerade their theology, and it worked. So now a lot of people are speaking about science with absolutely no expertise in science. It's so interesting how people are concerned about us impostering as women or men and not people impostering as vaccine experts or wildfire conservationists or biologists. These people flunked biology, by the way. In fact, what nature templates for us is a smorgasbord of possibilities around gender and sexuality that are so beyond any meager grasp of the binary. So yes, I do think there's a theological agenda at work here, but I'll take your provocation farther to say, no, it's not just distraction, because I think that there is something unique about transness that irritates authoritarian regimes. And I think that there is a reason why, as a student of history, I've devoted so much of my scholarship to understanding why colonists were so deeply concerned about the visibility of gender nonconforming people. When British people came to India, they sought the complete eradication of gender variant people.
Why?
And I think it's because we represent possibility. In a world in which we are told that other people get to make decisions about our bodies, trans people become ambassadors for autonomy. We show the world that your body and your life belong irrevocably and indisputably to you. And that, therefore, calls into question any structure of authority that has told you that you have to surrender your own personhood to someone else's jurisdiction. I think trans people also teach the world that change is possible. And authoritarian regimes want the status quo to masquerade as reality. When you see trans people, you understand that actually it is possible to change, that transformation is possible. And I think cynicism is the death knell of everything right now, especially in my country. There's this deep sense of malaise, and I don't feel it because I'm around people who are living miraculous lives, people who shouldn't exist and do, people who have found ways to alchemize some of the worst vitriol in the world into some of the most fabulous glamour that has ever existed. I see hope and possibility everywhere I go. So what I'm saying is people want to eliminate trans people to eliminate hope. And I think that's what's frustrating, is people think that this is just a minoritarian issue. This is us just being self-indulgent, they say. There are other bigger issues that are more pressing. And I say, fair enough, but I want you to understand the targeting of trans people isn't just about us. It's about creating a world that makes it okay for other people to tell you who you are.
One of the things that impresses me so much about your work is your sympathy for men and women who are men and women. Hmm. You have, it seems to me, real empathy for their situations. How is that?
Well, I understand, because everything that people say negatively about me are things that I've said to myself too. And the reasons I said those things to myself were because I grew up in a society that taught me that the only way I could belong is if I fit in. If I disappeared myself, shapeshifted and muted myself, contorted myself into a preconceived image of what other people needed. And so when I saw people, including myself, who visibly defied what I had been told was good and normal and beautiful, I had this incensed reaction in me too. But then I went to therapy. And in therapy,
yes.
I realized that my judgment of other people was actually a shield to protect me from my own internalized shame, from my own self-hatred. And as I began to learn how to love myself, I felt no need to judge other people, because I was spending my days doing fun things like eyeliner tutorials and dyeing my hair rainbow. I was less concerned about what other people were doing. Now I can just wear a fresh produce dress and not care. But when you're so obsessed with what other people think about you, prejudice becomes a convenient bridge that you can walk away from your own problems too. So I read a lot of the vitriol against people like me is a confession of deep and existential pain. And I have mercy for that, because I've been there. And so I think it's not individual people's fault that they are homophobic or transphobic. I think that it's a society that offers homophobia and transphobia as a drug to anesthetize people from their own woundedness.
You have an interesting theory about the origins of men's fashion. I'm wondering if you could share that with our listeners.
Yeah, sure. So what people don't really know is that the sex distinction in Western fashion is a relatively recent phenomenon. Dress used to be more differentiated by religion, class, and profession than sex. So a lot of the things that we see as feminine now, like makeup, heels, wigs, tights, were actually worn by men, especially in the aristocracy. But it was only in the early 19th century that we began to see the bifurcation of men's fashion and women's fashion. And around 1820, we see the suit become consolidated as the kind of paradigm of masculinity. Suit designers were taking inspiration from Greek and Roman sculpture to accentuate the torso of men, and pant legs were defined against the silhouette of a skirt to represent men as autonomous and having agency, whereas women required subordination and support and assistance from men. So what we see is a hyper-emphasis on gender distinction in fashion that really emerges in the early 19th century and takes a fever pitch by the end of the 19th century. And so what's so interesting is that at that point, for a woman to wear pants was seen as cross-dressing. In fact, there was an entire dress reform movement in the late 1800s, early 1900s, with women advocating for the right to wear pants, called like the Rational Dress Society. And when they would be giving these lectures, they would be spat on in public, laughed at, physically assaulted. Men would say, "You're destroying Western civilization when you wear pants." Fast forward a whole century later, and we see the exact same rhetoric being used against so-called men in dresses.
But to put it perhaps a little more plainly, you see that the purpose of men's fashion is to accentuate the genitals.
Yeah.
And the purpose of women's fashion
is to hide. To hide, but also to be a projective landscape for man's fantasies, so that men can abstract what they want women to be on the canvas of women's fashion, and so that men can justify women's role in society as ornamental.
But surely this has profoundly changed in the last 20, 30, 40 years.
Yes, it has changed. First and foremost, thanks to lesbians. I mean, thank you, lesbians.
We have so much to thank lesbians for, not only good
so
sense.
So much. So many lesbians and butches began to wear pants and would be laughed at and degraded and would keep on going outside anyways and began to make pants gender neutral. And I'm continuing that legacy by saying that dresses and skirts are also gender neutral. Everyone should be able to wear them. It's just a garment of clothing.
Well, of course, as a proud Scot, of course, we're used to...
Yes, exactly.
...men in skirts with knees, mm-hmm. all visible. Mm-hmm. Language. Language is difficult. Now, we've mentioned already what Australia could contribute to this debate with the plural yous. Mm-hmm. Is there a way, or is the defence of you part of... you know, asserting independence. But is there another way of us using pronouns? I was so struck by that ad that the Trump people used in the last days of the campaign. Mm-hmm. She is for they, them. Yeah. We are for you.
Yeah. I really feel like it must have been a friend of mine who wrote that ad. Because I just don't know if anyone's smart enough in that campaign. And
I really
hope that they got paid well, because I'm kind of miffed that I didn't come up with it myself. It's quite genius. Yeah, it's interesting, this politicization around pronouns, right? Because I think that people forgot. They're like, I don't want to use pronouns, but like, you is a pronoun. You know, we're using pronouns all the time. And there's this smokescreen of grammar, right? Like, these people who have absolutely no hot takes on an Oxford comma or even really the difference between like there and there, now all of a sudden are like kind of ambassadors for grammar. It's not about grammar, it's about power. The history of this world is that every single language has a derogatory slur for LGBTQ people. And so people are comfortable with us when we are objectified and when we're ridiculed. But whenever we use language to have subjectivity and to rehumanize ourselves, that becomes a threat. Language has been designed to justify mutilation of our dignity. And when we create language that is actually about respect for our magnificence, that becomes seen as a threat. People say, you keep on making up new words, but all words were made up. these people who are upset about made-up words don't have concerns about the word viral being recontextualized around internet media. We understand that language's purpose is to more effectively communicate. What they get upset about is when historically disenfranchised people actually have access to the means of production of language and meaning.
Is this particularly a problem in English?
Yes. There's many languages across the world, especially indigenous languages, that don't use gendered pronouns. English is a particularly gendered language. But I know my friends who are speaking in Spanish and other colonial languages are facing the same issues.
You say English is a particularly gendered language, but we don't have gender for our nouns.
That's true.
Surely it makes us stand aside from gender. I mean, compared to French or Italian or German, everything is
totally
determined by that.
Fair point. But what I'll offer is that a lot of people in your community are trying very desperately to gender nouns these days. I mean, the vehemence with which they'll gender a boat or gender a car and refuse that same dignity to a trans person. It's really remarkable.
Now, what about the word mother? Are we allowed to use the word mother?
I would think so, yeah. My hope is that we can get to a place where our relationship to definitions is actually self-determining. So mother could mean what you want mother to mean. People always are operating from a zero-sum ideology. If you mean woman when you say this, how can my meaning of woman mean this? And I'm like, oh, you think that diversity equals chaos when I actually think diversity equals the purpose of being alive. Like, the world has never been one-dimensional. It's always been obtuse and obstinate. The movement I'm espousing is not just one of gender plurality, but is one of being able to hold the complexity of terms having multiple meanings at the same time. I think that enriches our experience because it requires us to do what we're doing right now, to have conversations. There's few things more banal and crude than an assumption. And what is really joyful about a conversation is an antidote to that. It allows us to crawl into one another's lives and say, how are you experiencing this reality? That's the kind of intimacy we need to heal.
But we do need to be able to use words that have shared meanings.
Yes. And then we can come and talk about those shared meanings as they change over time.
What is a woman?
I would say that a woman is someone who says that they are a woman.
Self-proclaimed.
Mm-hmm.
Do you say I'm a man?
What? Would you say you were a man?
Oh, yes, I'm a... Honestly, look, of course I'm a man.
I don't want to make any assumptions. And you're allowed to change your mind at any point in this conversation.
Am I?
Yeah.
I could be persuaded.
Yes.
In another direction. No, I think I'm... Well, there's another Australian expression which is useful here, a bloke.
Yeah, they love that one for me in my hate comments. They say, a loke is a bloke, which once again,
rhyming.
Incredible. Yes, very charming.
A loke is a joke, a loke is a bloke.
Yes, they love to say, this bloke, a loke, is so attention-seeking. And I just love it when men seek my attention to let me know that I'm indeed attention-seeking. It's very charming.
When you look at these big men around the world and the politics of the world at the moment, which seems to be adoring these big men and not just Trump, what do you think of the sexuality of these big men, insisting on their masculinity, parading around with sort of bodyguards of toughs around them? It seems to me quite camp.
It's extremely camp. And I think people don't really understand that camp is not just a queer aesthetic, it's also a fascist aesthetic. It's also this overdone, kind of glazed, extreme, hyperbolic, self-aggrandizing. It's just not as fun when it comes from fascists. It's really not.
They're not
a buzzkill.
No.
What I think about them is I feel deeply sorry for them because it's obvious to me that they have daddy issues.
And it's daddy issues?
Yes, it's obvious that they wanted the validation from their father or from their families and societies and were made to feel like they weren't worthy of love unless they were a behemoth. And that's not what I believe. I believe every single being is worthy of love simply for being, not for doing. And I feel that there's a lot of grief and woundedness behind this. A lot of people are using muscle as armor, trying to shield themselves from what they feel. And I think there's a lot of men who are extremely lonely and extremely sad, but are dispossessed from the language to even say, I'm lonely and sad. So all that's made available to them is anger. And so I think anger is a place where a lot of men go because they don't know how else to feel. And so I feel pity. And what I genuinely want is mass free trauma-informed therapy for all people that takes masculinity seriously, that understands that men are in pain. And when I look at a lot of the things coming out from the men's rights movement, I'm like, wow, you guys are really grieving, but you keep on blaming and villainizing women. Women are not the issue. The issue is gender norms. Gender norms have taught us that men are not allowed to feel, that men have to always be in control and always be powerful. That's anti-humanity. Humans are inherently vulnerable. We would have died if we didn't need each other. And so we've created social scripts around masculinity that have estranged men from their own humanity.
But why?
I think that there's a couple of reasons. I think one, we thought that it would keep us powerful and strong, and it didn't. And we're really bad at pivoting because once something becomes familiar, our brain's like, this is home. Even if it's misery or a prison, we can still call it home because it's familiar. So I think we're stuck in a loop where someone had a conjecture a long time ago, hey, this might be a good idea, and now it's time to change it. I think, two, it's because people believe that power is monopoly over other people and not power is surrender. And what I really, I mean, a lot of my work is based off of the idea that living is just stand-up comedy because we die. So from the perspective of death, this is all a joke. I've always believed that. And so when I look at all these men with their male pattern baldness surgeries and their gender-affirming care through mass taking in testosterone, I'm like, aw, you're trying to circumvent the inevitability of your death. And you think that if you amass all the titles and all the distinctions and all the followers and all the women, you're going to somehow be able to cheat death, and you won't. Death is the ultimate democracy. And so I think also a lot of that comes from Western culture's inability and refusal to contend with mortality and to recognize that the true power is the people who can dance with death, not fear it. Those are the people I admire the most, not the people who are building empires to run away from death, but the people who actually can speak about it unflinchingly.
The Capitol insurrection riot was a moment of awakening for me. I didn't understand how people were so angry and like rioting and looting and stuff. I found it very unbecoming. So I joined a book club. We read authors who identify as white, straight, and angry in order to better understand the tendency towards temper tantrums in that community. And it was an incredibly healing journey for me when I realized I had to use my privileges to show up for marginalized communities.
I'm talking to Alok Vadmenon, poet, comedian, performer, advocate. This is the best of Late Night Live 2025 on ABC Radio National. Was January the 6th the celebration of that masculinity?
I think it was a celebration of that masculinity. I think we're seeing it all over the place. You just listen to any podcast today or go on TikTok and it's being glorified. And I'm really scared by it. Not just for me, but for so many men. I feel so lucky that I was raised with feminists who, even when I was doing the whole cosplaying as a boy thing, I had different models of masculinity. And I was taught that women are powerful and I was taught that men can feel. But I just feel like increasingly, there's fewer and fewer representations of less of empathetic masculinity. And I feel a lot of sadness that so many boys and men are being socialized into a world where they're not allowed to be tender and soft.
Alok, one of the things you do in your performances, which I find so extraordinary, is to tell stories They're not funny stories. They're poignant, moving stories. And it's a mix I've never seen before in stand-up comedy. Hmm. Where does it come from? How does it work?
One of my biggest issues with stand-up comedy is there's what people say on the stage and then there's what people say at the bar after. And at the bar after, most comics have been through the rigmarole of trauma. Death, grief, loss, depression, addiction. But there's this way in which if you name the reason that you're in pain and needing to make joke, it somehow feminizes and it somehow loses your credibility. So there's a way in which there's an ironic distancing that happens in a lot of stand-up, an inability to actually say, hey, everyone, I'm hurting, and that's why I'm making jokes. And what I try to do in my stand-up is say, the reason I need to joke is precisely because life is so freaking hard. So what I bake into my shows are stories or experiences of pain to show my method, which is when you have something painful, comedy comes in and provides a way to detoxify it and make it lose its stranglehold over us. I think it's kind of ancient, this practice of tragicomedy. And a lot of what I'm trying to do in my work is to reveal all binaries to be false, not just between man and woman, but between sorrow and joy, between comedy and poetry. I think all of these things need each other. Joy enhances our capacity to feel sorrow, and sorrow enhances our capacity to feel joy.
When Grandpa died, the hospice nurses told us that his death would be painless. I kept holding his hand and whispering in his ears, it's okay to go. You don't have to be afraid. I couldn't tell if I was speaking to him or to me. In the last months of his life, I lived in parentheses. They're the things that I said and they're the things that I felt. When he told me that he wanted to die, I said, okay. And then I went and cried in the other room. When the dementia came in like a reverse sunset, I told him that things were going to get better. I've never seen a more compelling case for lying than him sleeping next to his books because he couldn't read them anymore.
Alok, what is the power of poetry these days? Is it still powerful?
Yes, I think poetry is the most powerful thing on earth.
Why?
Philip Pullman once said that poetry is not just a fancy way of saying things. It's actually an incantation. It's a spell. And I believe it. When you find the correct amalgamation of words and you say it in the way that they were meant to be said, which is choreographing and sculpting silence as part of a sentence, the way that that lands in people is fundamentally different than all the garbage that's landing to us on our newsfeed because it sticks in us and it stays with us for a while. It's not just what we're saying, it's how we say it. And what a poet does is take information and think about how to communicate it so that we remember it. Remember, all of us began with oral traditions before language. And people were able to remember stories for thousands of years, not just because the stories were fun and interesting, but because the way that the stories were performed was poetic. Poetry was a dove, a messenger bird for so many life lessons. And I think a lot of the illness of the world right now is because we don't really have many places for people to come together and do that profoundly human thing, which is listen to someone tell a beautiful story. And I don't know about you, but anytime I hear anyone tell a beautiful story about their life, they're immediately available as a lever in my head. I remember that we're all just the same person. We're all navigating the same reality. And what stories and what poems do is they preach to us this fundamental truth that separation is an illusion. And we might look different on the outside, but on the inside, we're all having this flimsy and awkward version of living. And so I feel more than ever as a poet right now, it's important to have poetry. Because we're so inundated and so oversaturated with nonsense. And poetry is the thing that pierces through it.
What's the plan for you? I mean, your life has moved through so many important changes. Mm-hmm. Do you see yourself as a performer for the indefinite future?
Hmm. Well, first I wanted to answer what you were saying before. What happens when we don't create meaningful economic opportunity for poets is they end up having to take side hustle gigs for the Republican Party. So one thing we could take away from this is investing in the arts and allowing poets to just publish their freaking poetry chapbooks could do a really great job of taking some of our most talented and savvy wordsmiths away from political propaganda.
Or advertising agencies.
Yes, or advertising.
For whatever party. This is a government broadcasting station. Yes. You must understand that we must show here impeccable political
neutrality.
And I'd be as spruiking with you for the notion of making sure that the dissatisfied poet doesn't write for the Democratic Party or the Labour Party.
Right. Okay, cool. Fair enough. I'll hold that.
The problem with poets, and I don't know whether this is true in the United States of America, but certainly it's true, they are such a divisive lot.
Mm.
They fight amongst themselves in a way that is distressing.
It is true. I mean, I've never seen more contention, maybe in like a Facebook group for mid-century modern furniture. But other than that, I've never seen such deep investment in something that doesn't matter at the end of the day. To your question before about being a performer and what's next for me, I think that in response to a world that is so tremendously ugly, I mean, just despicable, my job on earth is to populate beauty. It's not just to critique the ugly, that's important, but it's to create something that is so viable, so irresistible, so alive that people remember that they're worth more than this tomfoolery. My job is to be professionally laughed at, not a presidential appointee. That's a separate position. And when I can make people laugh, my hope is to remind people that life can be great and worth living. And when we come together, it doesn't have to be through suspicion and fear and xenophobia. It can be through delight, and we can remember how strangers are just potential friends. And so I want to continue to make art for the rest of my life. And that will take many mediums, but I think at the heart will always be dark comedy. That's where I live, because dark comedy is how I live. It's how I survive hate crime after hate crime. It's how I survive the relentless tirade of hateful messages I receive, whether in person or on the street. I look at the entire world and I say, thank you for blessing me with this comedic material. And that sense of resilience, I think, is what we need right now when people are feeling dispirited and defeated. Remember, you can always crack a joke.
When Alok says dark comedy, their jeweled earrings quiver, absolutely quiver. It's very powerful. But Alok, addressing the darkness in the world is going to take more than comedy, isn't it?
Hmm.
What do you think that more than looks like?
I mean, regrettably, even if we were to curate a lineup with all of the goats, I don't think we could address the world's injustices, unfortunately. Here's the thing. It is so much easier for people to imagine the end of the world than it is for them to imagine healing and everything being okay. So it strikes me that the crisis begins first as a crisis of imagination, that people have been hardwired to believe that dystopia is the trajectory, and not that actually we could actually do it. We could create an equitable, just, and beautiful world. What it's going to take is a paradigm shift that people recognize that you could be listening to this conversation right now, wherever you are, and decide today is going to be the day that I decide to be free. I'm going to stop living a lie, and I'm going to actually show people who I really am, and I'm going to treat people with compassion, rigorous compassion. And then that small change is a quiet insurrection that will have reverberations across the entire world. That's how we change it. It's when people start making the everyday decisions to do something different. And I see that because that's so much of what my life is. I meet people every day who have no incentive to love, who in this political climate actually are galvanized to hate and make a differential choice. And I guess that's what is required of us right now, is to make the more difficult choice.
But against that are mighty forces, deeply organized, hugely resourced, to make sure those things don't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it going to also require politics?
Hmm.
Isn't it also going to require using the mechanisms of society for change?
Of course it is, but we have to.
How does that happen?
We have to use those mechanisms differently. We keep on operating at the same frequency. I reject the fundamental premise that there's one side and the other side. That's not really helpful. I think that everyone who is anti-trans right now is impacted by the same tyranny of the gender binary as me. And so we actually have so much more in common than we have apart. We are concerned with creating a safer world. We are concerned with having a dignified life. We have so much that we can work together. What is frustrating is that what I've seen is in response to polarization, people think that polarization will work against it. It won't. It's such a cliche, but sometimes cliches are kernels of truth. We cannot fight fire with fire. We have to operate a different frequency. So if we're occupying traditional institutions like politics, let's do it differently. And what that difference looks like is often being stifled. When you see visionary leadership these days, the old vanguard will be like, nope, nope, absolutely not, nope, status quo.
That doesn't work, no. Yeah. But right now, in the face of Trump and those extraordinary executive orders that he signed in the first sort of 20 days, 10 days, 20 days, how do transgender, non-binary, and intersex Americans live?
I feel like there's few things less poetic than an executive order. I would say an executive order is the
especially one signed with that signature
is the antithesis of a good poem. We live by doing what we've done for centuries. What I need people to understand is we are not new to this. It used to be illegal in this country and my own for trans people to exist in public. There were a series of cross-dressing laws that would throw us into prison just by appearing in public. We would be thrown into prison 20 to 40 times, and guess what? We'd dust off our heels and we'd come back right outside. I come from one of the most powerful legacies on this earth. We have survived attempted eradication. So of course we're going to make it through this. That's not a question to me. I know my history. I've met my transcestors. I've met people who, against all odds, found ways to manifest and femifest themselves. Where I have doubt is if the people who are harming us are going to maintain a semblance of their own humanity. That's where my concern is. I know trans people are going to be fine. What I worry is the people who have become love drunk with hating us, whether they're going to be able to look at themselves in the mirror on the other side of this, because the internet doesn't forget. And so in 5 years, in 10 years, in 15 years, in 20 years, when people look at this moment as embarrassing, a stain on our collective conscience, are you really going to be able to look and say, wow, I bought into that BS? I feel bad for you that way, because you're having an opportunity right now to make the decision, which is I'm going to love in the face of difference. I might not understand it. I think that's where we get bent out of shape. A lot of people say, I don't understand this thing. And I'm like, I don't actually require comprehension. I'm asking for basic compassion. Know that I'm another human being having this experience to you. Why does my existence threaten yours? If you're going to make the decision to not be compassionate to a stranger, that's going to lasso back and impact you. So the reframe I'm trying to offer our listeners is that I don't believe in transgender issues. I believe in issues that non-trans people have with themselves that they're taking out on us. And I know trans people are going to be fine. My question is, are cis people going to survive this?
Alok, thank you. I've been talking to Alok Vadmenon, comedian, poet, performance artist, advocate, who has been touring Australia. Alok, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for the week. Thanks, as always, to the Late Night Live team, led by executive producer Jack Schmidt. Next week, in summer mode again, we're bringing you more of the best of 2025. Indeed, the pick of the crop. Until then.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.